our time here is half the time that I have been given off from my institution to study for a while. We have an institution which provides us with a year off after every 6 years of full-time teaching, if we have a reason. And the reason that I had and presented a couple of years ago to my institution was desire to do more concentrated study focused on one particular part of the Christian Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, the book of Isaiah, one of the large prophetic books, and in particular those chapters in Isaiah numbered 40 through 55. And the reason that we are going to be studying together the subject that's announced is my studies of Isaiah 40 through 55 led to what I would call a search question. And as you know, the way it is with searches is that we often go into them thinking we know what we're going to find out. And we often frame the beginning question, or draw the map, or project the trip in such a way as to suggest that we know where we're going to get. But as you know, as often happens along the way, though your starting place can't be changed, the route you take and the destination you reach are subject to a lot of changes and alterations. And in this course, I am looking forward to your questions, your contributions, your responses to what we're doing as assistance to me, as help to me, particularly I'm looking forward to those times when you question my explanation of what we're doing, because I'm one of those people who has discovered through the years that the best part of teaching is learning from your students, and so I expect to learn from you. Now, let me run through the course outline with you just briefly so that you know what I mean by what I've put down here. The title is An Archaeological Interpretation of Babylon in the 6th Century B.C., Humans, Deities, and Their Relationships. An Archaeological Interpretation. There are some written records related to Babylon, which have survived through the centuries without having to be discovered by archaeologists, but most of our information about ancient Mesopotamia and Babylon comes to us as a result of archaeological work, a great deal of which was done in what is today Iraq during the 1900s, the 1800s, and continues into the present. Now, the purposes of the course, please notice that the first purpose is to introduce the main features of ancient Mesopotamian culture and civilization. The reason I use the two words culture and civilization are these. These words are often used as though they stood for each other. But if you look at where they come from, their Latin background, and if you look at the combinations in which they're used in our studies, I think you will discover that culture, more often than not, puts the emphasis upon how humans are related to their natural environment. And that civilization, on the other hand, puts the emphasis, and again I said, they overlap, and sometimes the two of them are hard to distinguish, but civilization, coming from the word city, puts its emphasis upon the way humans relate to each other. For instance, we have terms like horticulture and agriculture, all kinds of combinations like that which have to do with the way humans relate to the non-human part of the world. Most civilizational references have to do with interrelationships of people, the way in which they agree to live together, the ways they develop for conducting life with each other, the institutions, documents, traditions, and customs. So, first purpose is to do some introduction on that, with the assumption that though we vary in our background and in our knowledge of it, we all need to be introduced or reintroduced to each other and to subjects from time to time. Second thing, and really the most important for me, and perhaps it will become for you as we move along, is to explore and interpret the religion and world understanding of the Babylonians in the 6th century B.C. Now, the important part of that number two is the last part, through a study of artistic representations of deities and humans. The focus in this course will be primarily upon the art that has been recovered that is pertinent and related to who the deities were, how they were described, how they were understood to function, how humans and the deities were related, primarily through the way in which those were presented artistically. But, as number three said, we will also relate that to select texts. We couldn't possibly deal with all of either category. Can't possibly deal with all that is known, the thousands of texts that are available from ancient Mesopotamia are just beyond the grasp of an individual and almost and exceed the time available in many lifetimes for their comprehension. Tens of thousands. Fourth purpose of the course is to compare and contrast those Babylonian understanding with our own. Hidden in number four is something that I've tried to find the words to say and will keep trying to find the words to say as we move along. And that is, first of all, to try to gain an appreciation and some empathy with, rapport with a people dead and gone and far away from us, not just in time, but in cultural distance. Another way to say that is to say that we are like aliens trying to find our way into another culture and to come to an understanding of it so that we can move around in it. And in this case, unlike those experiences we have as aliens in living situations, in this case, we're trying to move into a dead civilization and understanding. Now, it's only fair to say, and very important to say, that there are many, many people who say you can't do that. That there is no way that we can really do that. Now, your opinion and mine may not be very weighty in the long run of that discussion, but I think one can come to an appreciation of an alien culture and an alien civilization if you free yourself from the obligation to become completely at home in it. We are all so much part of where we come from. But you all know the difference between a sympathetic visitor and a hurried tourist. There's time, patience, and observation. Listening, attempts to learn the language and all of that. Well, part of our purpose in this course, listed as number four, is to attempt to listen and to gain rapport with that civilization dead and gone, which we call ancient Babylon. Now, what we're going to do, and I put a schedule down here. And my understanding of schedules is that they're targets. They're not cubby holes that you have to lock yourself in with. But this is what I'd like to do, is touch the bases that are listed here. The first three sessions are by way of orientation. And then sessions beginning on October 26th focus on those deities which my studies have indicated to me were predominant in the life and understanding of the world in Babylon in the 6th century B.C. Then October 31st, November 2nd, November 7th, the same four sessions on that. And then a summary session on in which are the basic categories which I understand to be the functions of the gods and goddesses of Babylon, namely to order and to reorder the world for humans. There's a reading list here, and I tried to limit myself primarily to books that are in the Acor Library. You try to go up there and get them, you may find that they're on my desk. And if you want to read them, the library agent will no longer let you take books out of the building. But even if they're on my desk, go ahead and read them. There are many, many others up there that would be useful to you, but these are the predominant ones. Okay, now tonight. And let me say this. I think David suggested to me, and Linda McCurry also certainly did, that I did not have to encourage the folks who come to ACOR for these courses to ask questions. But I will encourage you to do so at any time. If I get lost as a result of that, we won't worry about it. I sure won't worry about it. But I am very concerned to have you ask questions. Now, I also reserve the right, when you do ask them, to handle them in the way that I think would be best at the time and for the sake of the course and for all of us together. And in order to be sure that your questions don't get lost, one of the things that Jane does for me with great regularity when I do public presentations of various types is write down the questions that are asked so that if handle them at the time they're asked. I have them before me to address it. So don't hesitate to ask questions. And since I said that, do you have any questions right at this point? David?
Just looking at your list, I'm not sure we got this book upstairs, but I think we do.
Which?
One of the most interesting works I ever read on Egyptian Mesopotamian religion was Frankfurt's Kingship of God. So at least I read this. We don't have it. If we do have it, I'd just like to hear your opinion. Do you think that is a good work?
I was planning to read it here.
No, I didn't.
Let me look at your
Kingship and the Gods. And we'll be talking a good bit about kingship, especially next Monday night when we talk about the organization of life of Babylon and the critical role played by the royal figures in the understanding of life, and particularly in the relationship of humans and the deities. David, I think that book's not up there. I conducted several searches in the last 5 weeks. I don't believe it's listed anywhere. Now, tonight I have three things I want to do. And if that tells you that in addition to what David told you, I'm also a Presbyterian minister and accustomed to organizing things in threes, so be it. The first is the search, second is the scene, and fourth is the sources. Third is the sources. Now, everything we cover tonight, we're going to, including the 24 pictures that I have over here, if we get through them, we will come back to again in a concentrated way. But tonight I want to fly over the terrain once and let you know where we're headed and what we're up to. In studying Isaiah 40 through 55, which contemporary biblical scholarship almost completely agrees was presented as poetry in the 6th century BC in Babylon by a poet whose name we're not that sure of. In studying that portion of the book of Isaiah, as I have done for several years in connection with teaching and my own curiosity, I have been struck by the way in which this poet invests words and poetic and prose efforts in dealing with the gods of Babylon. If we are correct about his audience were those descendants of people who had been carried off from Palestine, from southern Palestine, from Judah, in the years before and shortly after 587 BC. And this poet is addressing them somewhere around 540 BC, over a generation later. There may have been some people who still survived from those those who had been taken captive and led away from their homeland to Babylon. But by and large, those he addressed must have been their children and, in many instances, grandchildren. His purpose seems to have been to prepare them for some events which were about to happen, which were going to change their situation to make it possible for them to return to their homeland. And he seems to have organized his poetry, and I say he because I don't know any different. He seems to have organized his poetry to address their fear because of all the changes taking place in part of the world and the time where they live. Their resistance to leaving, because many of them had settled down and begun to make their homes there. And some of them could have said, when he tried to get them to leave, well, your predecessor, Jeremiah, wrote us a letter, or wrote our forefathers, our fathers and mothers a letter and said, settle down in Babylon. Don't wait for a return. Look for the peace of Babylon and settle down, raise children, plant crops. As he spoke and wrote, he apparently regarded the deities of Babylon as a serious issue for him and those to whom he was speaking. And throughout his book, there are many sections related to the deities of Babylon at the time. And you get the impression that he is trying very hard to free these people from the influence of the religion of which these deities were a part, so that they can respond to what he is saying in the name of the God of their forefathers and can get them to leave. Now, one of the longer passages is this one. Listen. They are all makers of idols. They are nothing, and the works they prize are useless. Their servants see nothing. They understand nothing, and so they will be put to shame. Whoever fashioned a god or cast an image without hope of gain. Watch how its devotees will be put to shame, how its sculptors will blush. Let them all come together. Let them appear in court. They will be both terrified and ashamed. Now, if we go along, I get the distinct impression. May share as you listen that he is talking from firsthand observation. The blacksmith works on it over the fire and beats it into shape with a hammer. He works on it with his strong arm till he is hungry and tired. Drinking no water, he is exhausted. The woodcarver takes his measurements, outlines the image with chalk, carves it with chisels, following the outline with dividers. He shapes it to human proportions, and he gives it a human face for it to live in a temple. He cut down a cedar, or else took a cypress or an oak which he selected from the trees in the forest, or maybe he planted a cedar and the rain made it grow. For the common man, it is so much fuel. He uses it to warm himself. He also burns it to bake his bread. But this fellow makes a god of it and worships it. He makes an idol of it and bows down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. On the live embers he roasts meat, eats, and is satisfied. He warms himself too. Ah, says he, I'm warm. I have fire here. With the rest, he makes his god, his idol. He bows down before it, and he worships it and prays to it. Save me, he says, because you are my God. That kind of satire, criticism, that kind of making fun, but very serious fun, of what was going on around him, indicates that at the time, this was a very important issue. And the picture which you get from reading that is a very negative picture. And I said, well, that's kind of foolish. Sure. Well, as I've worked with Isaiah 40 through 55, reading that kind of thing has made me ask myself the question, how did the Babylonians understand these deities of which he makes so much fun, which he criticizes as being unable to hear, unable to speak, unable to help? How did they do? How did they understand these deities and themselves in relationship to them? How did they present them? And so I began several months ago to start looking into that in an effort to get an answer to it. And for the next few minutes, I'm going to show you the kind of place we're talking about, the scene, Babylon, and the kinds of sources, archaeological sources, which one has to deal with and which one has available to answer a question like that. And the question I put to myself is, how did the gods and goddesses of 6th century Babylon function? Babylonian society. The scene is the land, part of the world that we call Mesopotamia, in the middle of the rivers. Down at the southern end of this series of valleys and plains and land along the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers is this marshy place at the head of the Arabian Gulf, where the rivers come together and where the land is supersaturated. And if you saw the movie that was recently shown at the British Council, where we had the opportunity to visit the Marsh Arabs, where people make islands out of reeds and houses out of reeds and live a life that is based on the water. Now, this particular part of Mesopotamia is important to the search which I'm conducting. We have a visitor. Unlike the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians did not deify cats. This part of southern Babylonia, Mesopotamia, is important to the story because that area is the area which connects the upper part of Babylon to the Arabian Gulf and to the sources of contact and trade with other ancient people and cultures. Go ahead. There. Got rid of her. She's out. The period of time, the 6th century Babylon that we're talking about, is time which is characterized by the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, also known as the Chaldean dynasty. And the Chaldeans had a great deal to do with this lower part of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which you see partially portrayed here. This particular slide also refers to the period of time we're interested in because it shows you the empire of Nebuchadnezzar II. Nebuchadnezzar II was the Babylonian king primarily responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem and the removal of the inhabitants of that part of Palestine to Babylon. He ruled from about 605 BC to 562. And the extent of his empire is represented on this map by what is in pink, which you'll note. Notice, goes from Sinai, through Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, including Edom and Moab, and this locality where we are, up in eastern side of his domain was the Median Empire. Persian plateau is here. And then the Elamites, others figure in the picture, as you can see here, including the Arameans. And if I were drawing this map, I think I'd move that up a little bit. Now, the area which we've just seen in the previous picture is down in this area where the combined rivers flow into the Gulf. What we normally refer to as, and you'll notice the word Chaldeans right here, showing their relationship with that lower part of the valley. What we refer to as Babylon or Babylonia is the part from right above the word Akkad, which you see here, down to the area which we've just talked about. Now, among the cities, ancient cities then and now, are Eridu, Ur, Larsa, Lagash, Nippur. And then as we get up close to Babylon itself, Borsippa, Kish, Babylon, and then Sippar. North of this artificial dividing line, although it does have this going for it, namely that the two rivers come very close together at that point, is what we refer to as Syria, Assyria, focused primarily on the Tigris Valley. And here you have Nineveh, Nimrud, Asher, Arba'ilu or Arbael, and several others. Now, Mesopotamia is this whole area between these rivers and along them, which covers the eastern half of what we refer to as the Fertile Crescent. If you were here last week for Dr. Dornemann's presentation of work on the Euphrates, he was showing us the Euphrates area right along in here. Notice that the Euphrates begins way up here, up in here. Gaining water from these various tributaries coming down here. It's not as violent a river as the Tigris, because the Tigris is fed by more mountain streams than the Euphrates. But their annual flooding and the control of that flooding and the redistribution of the water for agricultural purposes is an important part of the story of Mesopotamia. Now let's take a look at another map that is in black and white and may give you a better shot at some of those names that we were looking at. We'll be looking at using these maps again. Important part for tonight is to distinguish between Babylon or Babylonia down here in the south and Assyria up in the north, and to see the relationship to the Arabian Gulf, to the surrounding countries, to the Arabian Desert. Our sources for studying Babylon and its culture and civilization are, first of all, written sources, which have been recovered by archaeological work and then further recovered by the strenuous effort of deciphering that were carried out long time ago and are still going on.
Can we turn on the backlights?
Sure.
Didn't miss it.
No, I don't think so. We can have light. Okay. Now, we're not going to deal with all this except to characterize it in general. First characterization is that we're dealing here with writing that's done primarily on clay in a system of writing called cuneiform, which is up here on the board, which means the impression of clay with a wedge-shaped stylus, the end of the stylus that's wedge-shaped, in various combinations so as to produce a writing system. Now, whether you're looking at it for the first time or looking at it for the most recent time after years of study, it is a very complicated writing system. Early on, it was primarily a pictographic system, then developed into a system in which these little clusters of wedges stood for vocal, vowel sounds, syllables, whole words. Now, what is significant about this for us is the amount of writing that's available from ancient Mesopotamia. And for reasons of convenience, let me categorize it into two basic categories. First is what one can call a literary tradition. From the time that this system was developed for use with the Akkadian language in 2300s BC or thereabouts, down to the threshold of AD, there was a strong tradition of scribes who copied and recopied ancient texts as part of their curriculum in learning this difficult system of writing and the languages for which it was used. Now, for our pursuit, the primary language we want to talk about is Akkadian. It's also up here on the board, which has a northern and southern divisions in it, Assyrian and Babylonian. The literary tradition was primarily a curriculum for the training of scribes and consisted of texts preserved primarily for that purpose, but also as the body of literature which that tradition regarded as necessary for an education. Now, surprisingly, just to give you one example, surprisingly, one of the largest groups of texts in that literary tradition were texts on which were recorded what are called omens. This was a vast encyclopedic repository of observations of happenings in the heavens above and among animals and people that had been noted at various times to be in conjunction with some event that affected human welfare. And so they recorded these very carefully in order to use them for future reference when such things would happen again, in order to know whether they meant good or bad for the king and for the people, for the nation. So in this literary tradition, you have a large body of those. also have a lot of dictionary type materials, bilingual dictionaries, dictionaries of old expressions and old words for the sake of later scribes in their own translation work and their own study. Now, leaving that for the moment, the non-literary tradition is the tradition in which records were kept, letters were written by people for reasons other than literary. Royal inscriptions and histories and materials like that. What we have in the cuneiform writing system and in the Akkadian language are texts of a vast variety of types which provide all kinds of information and at which a great many scholars in the world spend their lives. Here, for instance, is a clay cylinder with a long inscription by this same Nebuchadnezzar, whom we mentioned a few minutes ago, Nebuchadnezzar II. This is a foundation cylinder. It was designed to be placed in the foundation of a building in a way similar to the way people put things in the cornerstones of the buildings for reference some future time. This particular one over here, you notice, is not clay, but it's stone, because cuneiform was also done on stone, certainly not with stylus, but with some kind of chisel. This little thing and the proportions here are not accurate, is a weight. And the text on it said, now this weight is an accurate replica of the royal weight, which at that time was approximately a kilogram, this particular weight that they're referring to. That kind of data also. The text that people have paid, perhaps more people have paid most attention to since they became known, are texts similar to the ones represented here, which tell such things as the way in which the Babylonians talked about the flood and the traditions they had related to an early flood in the early history of humankind, and other mythological and epic type literature, including an epic of creation, how the world became orderly out of preceding chaos. But alongside the written materials which we have available to us are a great many materials like the other ones in this picture, which you see here, in which the artists have presented their interpretation of life, their message about life in a variety of ways. Here you see a picture which is assumed to be a picture of mother goddess nursing a human. Here are humans bowing before an altar, but on that altar, instead of the representation of a human-looking deity like this, you have something very abstract. The artistic tradition can also be pursued through the architecture of ancient Mesopotamia. Here, for instance, are reconstructions of the town plans of Ashur, the capital of Assyria, and Babylon, the traditional capital of the southern part of the country, and what is often called the spiritual capital of Mesopotamia. Architecture. Here in the lower picture is a picture of the way in which the mound at Ur down in the south was found. excavated. Oops. What was that? What are you doing? I can reverse it. What happened? If you put it in, I'll reverse it. Something stuck? Is that stuck? And above, you have an attempt at reconstructing what this originally looked like. Again, architectural resources for doing this. In Babylon, there was a processional gateway that was used for periodic festivals and for processions of the deities. And it is known as the Ishtar Gate, here reconstructed in the Berlin Museum. Now, striking thing about this, just from a technological standpoint, is that this is mud brick you're looking at. Now, if you've looked at mud brick structures, I don't believe you've seen any like this. But these are glazed mud bricks shaped into the figures of these animals that you see. Here. We'll come back to those. In addition to that, a reconstruction of the town plan of Babylon, particularly with regard to its own tower made of mud bricks with a temple on top and its vicinity. A frieze on the wall of the palace in Babylon has reconstructed. Now, a wall mural from 1,000 years before that period and way upriver in Mari, portraying a goddess empowering a king with the right to rule. Notice the bare leg and foot on the animal below. Down here, goddesses with vases which flow with water. When we're talking about the literary tradition, this particular king, Ashurbanipal, who ruled in from 668 to 627 BC, was a very active and powerful king. Notice 42 years of rule, a very long time. Here he has portrayed himself with a combination of high relief sculpture in stone and an inscription telling how he not only commissioned sponsored the rebuilding of an important temple in Babylon, but how he himself even carried baskets of dirt for its construction as the servant of the deity for whom that was being built. Ashurbanipal was also a self-styled literary and mathematical man, and he is the one who during his time established a library in Nineveh and had texts collected from all over the land, about 1,200 texts, which were discovered in 1853, 130 years ago, and provided a huge amount of material for decipherment, translation, and interpretation. Notice the way in which he's portrayed. We'll come back to this one again because of the characteristic way. Going back before him 1,000 years, here is the great king Hammurabi, before the sun god. Notice, as in the mural we saw just a few minutes ago, that the deity has in his hand a long stick and a ring extended out to the king, just as it was in that mural from about the same time. This is at the top of tall stele on which the Hammurabi law code is found, and tells us how he was ordered by the sun god, the god of justice, to establish, to promote the welfare of the people of the land. Another king rebuilt a temple for the sun god and presented himself here, being led to the sun god by one of the sun god's servants, and then behind him a female deity interceding on his behalf to the sun god. Notice above the sun god's head these three symbols: the moon, star, and sun disk. And then down below, of course, the inscription go along with it. Or take a statue like this, in a relief like this one of Esarhaddon, who was predecessor of Ashurbanipal. Here he has got some captives tethered by the line that goes up into his hand where his mace is held, his royal scepter. Notice above here all these symbols. Those are the things that in this course we're going to come back and focus on, because they are the symbols of the deities of Babylon, and being placed up there above the figure of the king indicate that it was under their auspices and with their help that he accomplished what he accomplished. Another similar thing, only this is what we know as Kuduru. The word is down here. These are stones, carved stones, anywhere from about 2 feet to 3 feet high, which were placed in the ground to mark a royal grant of land to some person. And what is interesting to me about them is the way in which the symbols of the deity's figure are on them, indicating that these royal grants are under the guardianship of these deities. Notice again the star, the moon, sun, quite frequent, but all over the place. A couple more minutes. Another category of material are the famous cylinder seals. These are little cylinders, hollow, into which is carved, cut, a picture. And when you roll that across a soft surface like clay, you get the picture in a positive image, as you do right here on this tablet, which also has writing on it. This is called glyptic art, and I've often thought myself, anybody ever sat down and said, what's the most difficult way we can find to make pictures? This certainly must come close. To do it in reverse. And this is the kind of beautiful results they've achieved with this. Here's just a set of 8 impressions of these. Why they're important, again, is that they were used for commerce and trade, for witnessing agreements, for marking ownership, and they pick up on themes related to the deities and present the relationships between deities and humans in a form that was readily transportable and could move around with people. It wasn't like a huge statue or a building, often a special place, but was part of the everyday. Here is another set of such impressions. We'll focus on these to see what they tell us about the understanding of the deities and their functions and relationships. Here's a line drawing of the impression of one of these cylinder seals of the god of Babylon, the chief god of Babylon, Marduk, also known as Baal, B-E-L, right down there, standing on his dragon. And the next time I show that picture, it's going to be complete. I'll move it up. That's from the 9th century. Now, as you've been looking at some of these things, you may have picked up various designs and symbols that have been part of it, a part of the presentation. And here is simply a summary study by a scholar, by a scholar named Elizabeth Van Buren of the various symbols associated with the deities of ancient Mesopotamia. This has been a very quick survey of the reason I've asked the questions about these deities, the scene, and the sources that we have available for study. And because it is nighttime, could you turn on this one too? I want to read you just one brief text. This book has few of the available texts. Let me see this big book. Huge big book. It has few of them in translation. This one is called A Prayer to the Gods of the Night. They are lying down. Bolts are fallen, the fastenings are placed, the crowd and people are quiet. The open gates are now closed. The gods of the land and the goddesses of the land, sun, moon, storm, Venus, have betaken themselves to sleep in heaven. They are not pronouncing judgment. They are not deciding. Veiled is the night. The temple and the most holy places are quiet and dark. The traveler calls on his God. And the litigant is tarrying in sleep. The judge of truth, the father of the fatherless, son, has betaken himself to his chamber. O great ones, gods of the night, O bright one, O warrior, O bow star, O yoke star, O Pleiades, Orion, and the dragon, O Ursa Major, goat star, and the bison, stand by. And then in the divination which I am making, in the lamb which I am offering, put truth for me. One of the kinds of texts we'll be looking at, trying to understand, appreciate, be prayers like that. Thank you for listening.
Started off tonight with
No, not really. I shouldn't just. That's what I'd like to know. I say no because if they did, he wouldn't have had to criticize them. If the people who were making them and using them had the same kind of critical attitude toward them, he wouldn't have had to deal with it. It wouldn't have been important. No, that positively they understood it quite differently. My question is how?
I'm just wondering if it's conceivable, actually it seems to be quite conceivable, that perhaps your typical Babylonian would have viewed an idol in very much the same way, say, in Christian tradition, that icons or a crucifix is representing some other reality. More veneration from the average American history than a lot of people basically is in this way as a symbol of the deity rather than the deity itself.
Okay. And the question that comes up, and that's one of the ones that I want to deal with, is why did they represent their deities primarily in human form? What does that mean? And what do these symbols stand for, if we can go? And fortunately, we learned from a lot of people who spent a good deal of time studying them. I think you noticed the frequency with which the moon, the sun, Venus were shown. Trinity. The way you're putting the question is one of the ways I try to put it too. Any other questions? 17. By the way, anytime you write down